Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Haudenosaunee and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Mark Jacquard is a professor of sustainable energy at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. He has helped many governments with climate energy policy, including serving on the China Council for International Cooperation on Environment and Development and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. His latest book, The Citizen's Guide to Climate Success, is published by Cambridge University Press. First, I interview Jacquard to discover more about his environmental philosophy, which, he admits, is somewhat contrary to many beliefs widely held by activists. After the interview, we have excerpts of his presentation at the sold-out Bay Area Climate Change Forum, held at Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario. Now, this evening you talked about concerned citizens and climate insincere politicians. What are your brief definitions of those two?
Right. So the reason I've talked about climate concerned citizens is really to do with issues that I raised in the raised in my book and in the talk about how not all humans are the same. And one of the ways in which we humans can delude ourselves is by thinking that, oh, if that other person just had the same information as me, they would have the same concerns as me. And they don't have a different self-interest or a different perspective. And so I just need to work her harder to inform them, and then they will have climate concern at the same level as I do. What I was trying to say to my audience, which I knew would be climate concerned citizens because they're the only ones who come to these things, was, don't assume you're going to talk everyone into this. And so instead ask yourself, wait a minute, in jurisdictions around the world where people are having success, how are they doing that? Oh, the climate concerned citizens are really effective. They're really strategic. And they're looking at key changes that need to happen and key policies, regulation prices. So that's what I meant by trying to tell people, you're a climate concerned citizen. They may not all be that way. I used a similar logic with climate sincere politicians and insincere politicians. Likewise, there's a tendency to say, Stephen Harper's against carbon pricing. I just don't think he understands how economically beneficial it is. And if we just better inform him, then that, you know, then he will support it. And it, again, is a failure to recognize that humans have different perspectives and different interests and different biases in what they're going to believe or not believe. And the fortunate thing is you don't have to convince climate insincere politicians to change their mind, but you need to make sure you don't let them get elected.
I'm glad you mentioned biases, because we all have biases and we bring them to every conversation we have with others. How can we fight against those biases?
Right, and I'm really glad that you prefaced it to say I'm not suggesting that any of us are sort of thinking machines, you know, rational thinking machines. We are all biased in some way. And so what I've done in the book and in the beginning of my talk is just tried to give people some little tricks they can use to challenge their thoughts. And because I think it's really important in order to have sort of coordinated, unified action on the policies we need for climate. I described a game that I play with my grad students where I make them tell us what's the argument. Are they pro or against nuclear or biofuels or large hydro or whatever, they make their argument, they believe in it passionately, and they really do a good job. Then I say to them, okay, now argue the opposite of that. Tell us why we should have nuclear power or we should have biofuels. And they do a poor job at that. And these are talented, smart graduate students, PhD students, master's students. And so that's kind of a fun demonstration for them. And eventually, some of them, most of them, I get them thinking more like how the model of how a critical thinking person or a scientist should be thinking, which is always wanting to challenge the ideas you have. Now, I know that doesn't mean they're going to become perfect thinkers, and I know I'm not. It's to always subject the things you believe in to what is the leading evidence out there. And an example would be that when I started out as a young professor, I thought energy efficiency was cheap, and I thought renewables would be cheaper than fossil fuels because we would run out of them. Slowly, I got excited, and the people in my lab, when we would see a leading scholar say, the Earth's crust is full of fossil fuels, and with little bits of innovation, that they'll just keep being used, and they'll be really low cost. And I had trouble believing that at first, but because I tried to follow this approach of getting excited about something that contradicts what I believe, I feel it made me more useful to society as a researcher and as a public engaged intellectual to say, we're deluding ourselves on this one. That's just one example, or a couple of examples, and it's affected me, but it also means that I'm hoping it can help people, you know, as I say, not suddenly become like a scientist purely, but we do need people to sort of see where some of their wishful thinking biases need to be set aside so that they can help focus on what has to happen, and some of their self-interest biases as well. But where it's self-interest bias, you probably won't have much success. I'm not asking to talk people in the fossil fuel industry into not still saying fossil fuels must be part of the future. It's more the climate-concerned citizens who I'm trying to make help be more effective.
And in your book, you also talk about the urge to make it an us or them or this versus that or must do this or must not do that. So talk about that.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I do believe that, you know, if you think climate is really important in our political process, and you see politicians who are climate insincere, then it is a little bit of us versus them. Like you have to be focused politically, strategic voting if you're not in a proportional representation system. So, you know, to make sure you've got the politicians who are more climate sincere, even if they're not perfectly climate sincere. But I am saying that we need to be able to compromise because the people who would keep us on this destructive path of staying with fossil fuels, they can have a lot of power in our society. It's a capitalist society. They will end up, because we still consume fossil fuels, or some of us do, a significant number, that creates a lot of revenue, that creates a lot of power for advertising and influence politically and so on. And so, you know, we need to make sure that we've helped the people who are more prone to be saying, I must prioritize the climate issue, and to make them effective in how they would do that.
And one of the examples you use in your book is Naomi Klein and some of her books. She outright says, we got to get rid of capitalism.
Oh, right. So, yeah, and continuing on with that, this thing that we're taking these strong positions that aren't necessary, and we may be hitching an agenda to the climate concern. And what I mean by that is, let's say, we'll start with Naomi Klein. Let's say every book she writes is she wants us to dismantle capitalism in a major way. Some of the things she writes I agree with, but the kind of profound change she wants. Well, I'm not even sure what she wants. If it's not capitalism, is it communism? Is it socialism? Is it anarchism? But whatever it is, she's sort of telling us, and she did in her book, This Changes Everything, that we actually need to to have this profound change in capitalism in order to solve the climate crisis. And I'm thinking, okay, and she's not talking about a violent revolution, I guess. So she means by voting. And so she means that now I have to convince people not only to be climate concerned, but I have to convince enough voters to also dismantle capitalism. And all of this in 2 decades. So it seems to me that that agenda hitching has made it more difficult than it needed to be. If I take something a little more benign, like someone who really doesn't think we should eat meat anymore, so they'll be very focused on, as if we eat less meat and there's less cattle out there, whether it's the way they use land or the methane emissions from their wastes or their breathing, then what they are wanting may be a good thing, but let's not tell ourselves that all human beings, you know, have to stop eating meat before we can solve this problem, because it's actually not true. And it makes it difficult. It almost has a paralyzing effect, is what I've observed, on climate concerned people, because they feel like they have to change everything in their lives. And the evidence does not support that. They need to change the car they drive and how they heat their home.
But you do focus on a couple of things: decarbonization and the fact that we're not going to get rid of fossil fuels. But there are ways to do a transition. You talk about regulations, or you talk about carbon pricing and how the two mix together.
Yeah. So so decarbonization is about fuel switching. It's about not burning coal to make electricity anymore on the planet, and not burning oil to move people and goods around on the planet. And then how do we do that? You can do it with regulations, and you can do it with carbon pricing, like a rising carbon tax. You do have to have at least one of those. But the point that I've been making is, if the carbon pricing is too politically difficult and it actually paints a bullseye on the back of the climate sincere politician, then we should make sure that that politician who wants to do the right thing knows that they can use regulations. And in some cases, those regulations are not that much more costly and can be way more acceptable politically.
Concerned citizens detect deliberate delusions and inadvertent myths, which may be from others, but it may be your own. Elect climate-sincere politicians who do effective policy, and eliminate your own personal emissions with not a whole bunch of things, but just 2 actions. And a key theme of the book is, as I said, to focus on our human biases and therefore to inward focus critical thinking. And one way to just can say a picture says 1,000 words, but also some very short quotes can do that. And I'm going to read a couple of short quotes to you about this topic. One of them is by a writer from almost 100 years ago, an American writer, Upton Sinclair, who said, "It is difficult to get someone to understand something when their salary depends on them not understanding it." And the second one is from the philosopher Bertrand Russell, also writing about 100 years ago, who said, "What someone believes on grossly insufficient evidence is an index into their desires." So we all know about this, and psychologists will have terms for it. The first, maybe self-interest bias, and the second, wishful thinking bias. And I'm going to be talking about how important it is to recognize these and the kinds of mechanisms that we ought to follow to do that. So of course we know that the major challenge is we have to stop burning coal, oil, and natural gas, right? Decarbonize. That's the crux of the problem. But if we look at that problem and look more critically at the evidence, there's 3 key challenges that will come out, and some of this will be troubling to you, and I'll talk about the evidence. It's the evidence from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, leading scholars in the world. The first is the myth that fossil fuels are expensive, meaning that the alternatives to fossil fuels are cheap. But in fact, fossil fuels are plentiful, high quality, and low cost. And their price falls with ongoing innovation. And as we try to switch away from fossil fuels, we'll lower the demand and the price will fall. And we've even been experiencing that. And therefore, they still offer the cheapest development path for the poorest people on this planet, the poorest 4-5 billion people on this planet. And so people in those countries are looking to follow the path of China. And China's an example here. Here's the greenhouse gas emissions, China in the yellow line, in that period of rapid economic development that they had, growing their economy, growing almost 10% a year, and you see in that period of time, they surpassed the United States, Europe, and now India and other countries are starting to follow that path. And they're doing it not because of some nasty corporations are forcing them to do it. It's the cheapest way to expand their electricity systems. It's the cheapest way to expand their transportation systems. The second myth is the myth of a voluntary global agreement. So decarbonization is a global problem. So we talk about, oh, here's what we're doing, so we're solving it. We need to figure out strategically how to be part of solving something that's a global problem, and that's very difficult. And one reason it's difficult is because we don't have strong or effective global governance institutions, and our diplomatic processes are very ineffective on this. And if you look at human diplomacy, it's been very ineffective over the years. There are some successes, of course, but over the decades and centuries, I should say. And therefore, in a global problem, it's hard for individual countries to lead because each is only a fraction of the problem and therefore only a fraction of the solution. And so what happens? Well, for 25 years, once a year, the rich countries and all the countries in the world meet together. They did it in Madrid last December. Next December, it's in Scotland. And they get together and they say, okay, let's make an agreement here. Now, we know it has to be a binding agreement. And they say, but we can get to that agreement voluntarily. We're all going to agree on what's a fair allocation. And so the poor countries say, well, you got to help us out. Otherwise, we'll use the cheap fossil fuels. And the rich countries say, yes, we agree. So we'll give you some money. And then they come together with these, and they're miles apart. And they have been for 25 years. And independent academic experts have written for almost 25 years why this will never result in a binding agreement that will significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And yet we still keep meeting and doing this. The third myth is the myth of a rational domestic policy-making process. Now, I don't need to talk a lot about this in Ontario right now, I think. But the task for climate-sincere politicians is difficult because fossil fuels are incumbent, so financial self-interest, that bias I talked about, motivates corporations and individuals to trumpet the benefits from continued use of fossil fuels. And also, even when, and then there's climate insincere politicians who can fake it, because we're trying to do a transition over several decades, so they can say, or even they can say, a decade and a half into the future, here's where I'll be. Oh, but I don't need to do much right now to get, I promise you, I will. And that can work with a certain percentage of voters, and especially the ones who are not as climate concerned as the people here. And the other thing is that climate insincere politicians can lie about the economic harm from effective policies, exploiting, for in the case of the carbon tax or carbon pricing, like the cap and trade that Ontario had, the anti-tax biases that some percentage of voters, doesn't have to be big, just has to be in swing ridings and just enough people who single issue vote, and that can be important. And so that can be happening whether we're talking Ontario or whether we're talking in France. So with these three challenges, right, the fantasticness of fossil fuels, the global nature of the problem, and then the fact that our own political processes, I think sometimes at municipal government levels, the processes are better. It's a sort of something more immediate than at our more senior levels of government. that we're challenged. And when people see all of that, there's a tendency to see this as a huge, multiple, multivariate, complicated problem. And so I just went and, in preparing these my talks for this book, I went and got a quote. I knew I could find one right away. And I'll read this one to you from a writer in ProPublica. Fossil fuels are so integrated into our lives that phasing them out would require us to change everything about how and where we live, how we get around, and how we make money. So doesn't that sound right? I mean, it's so complicated, it's so challenging, there's so many aspects to it. Well, I'm going to argue that it's really simple. The first is that we have to focus on key actions in key sectors. What are those key actions? Phasing out the burning of coal and oil, and in most uses of natural gas. And so you might have jurisdictions that are now moving to coal phase-outs, or China, Norway, others moving to gasoline phase-out. So those are the key actions. What are the key sectors? It's electricity and transportation. First of all, for electricity and for transportation, we have all the technologies that we need, and we know what their cost is. So I can calculate for you as an energy economist what it means for the standard of living, the budget of a typical household as we make that transition. And it's actually a very small impact over a couple of decades as we transition. Also, really important, remember the global nature of the problem. We can actually act unilaterally in these two sectors because they're domestic sectors. We're not part of trading internationally when it comes to electricity, and very little when it comes to our transportation system itself that we run internally in our country, in our economy. Whereas the major globally competitive sectors of industry, steel, cement, aluminum, chemicals, those are what we call trade exposed. We try to act in those areas, but we're much more restrained. So that was actions and sectors. And then what else do we have to do? Well, you talked a bit about policies. We have to have what are called compulsory policies. So those decarbonate, because fossil fuels are so cheap, and they're the best option, the decarbonization actions don't happen without compulsory policies. Compulsory policies are either regulations, and there's different kinds, or carbon pricing. And there's two different kinds. There's the carbon tax we have in British Columbia, or there's the cap and trade that Ontario had briefly and that Quebec still has with California. The non-compulsory policies, like giving people a subsidy to insulate their home, they can be important. They can accompany the compulsory policies, but they are not a substitute for the compulsory policies. And that's the important part of this. And I will leave it at that. So what are some basics about compulsory policies? We have to have carbon pricing and or regulations to drive decarbonization. But you notice I said and or. What does that mean logically? It means that carbon pricing is not essential. You can do this entirely with regulations. Or regulations are not essential, and you can do it entirely with carbon pricing. And this is true. Experts all agree on this. And yet you'll hear people telling you we have to price carbon emissions. It's not true. We may want to do that, but that's a choice, not an obligation to get to complete decarbonization. And in the regulatory side, there are flexible regulations that can be sometimes politically easier than carbon pricing, and yet almost as what we say economically efficient. That means it's low cost for the economy to get those emission reductions. And I give talks to policy people, and I will be again in Ottawa in 2 days, where I focus on how you make regulations more flexible so that it doesn't pick technology winners and allows some competitive processes that therefore help us to lower cost. But yet these are regulations, not carbon pricing. So that's pretty simple. Two sectors, very simple fuel switching actions. so it looks like it's simple. For three decades, experts have known a coordinated global effort won't happen voluntarily. Electricity and transportation are achievable and are globally critical, and that renewables won't be fossil fuels without carbon price or regulations. So if experts know this, what's holding back global decarbonization? And I'm going to now run through some of these things, and obviously some of them, as I said, are going to be troubling to some of you. In the book, if you see me kind of cavalierly dismissing something that is important to you here, I don't do that in the book, and I've been really happy with the reviews of the books by people who nonetheless hold dear to some of the things that I'm challenging you with here tonight. The first is sort of the easiest. It's the deliberate delusions that are kind of familiar to us. It's fossil fuel interests, or people who associate their interests with the continuation in the use of fossil fuels, will promote myths to stall action. That climate science is uncertain, this next fossil fuel project is essential, and we live these kind of things in Canada every day. We have to wait for major innovation to decarbonize, which is completely untrue. And there's no point in acting until we have a global agreement. But I just showed you how you can act. You can work on the domestic sectors, and if you flip them, you've actually gotten halfway where you needed to go without a global agreement. The second one, though, and that relates to that exercise I was talking about at the beginning, about debating yourself. And that's when we tend to stick to some very rigid pro and con views. And a lot of climate-concerned people can be like that, looking at our decarbonization actions and policies. They'll say, we mustn't have nuclear. Or, I've seen, we must have nuclear. We mustn't, or we must use large hydropower. We mustn't use biofuels. I hear that all the time. We're already using biofuels all over the place, in Brazil, and you could be doing it in other semi-tropical countries. Biofuels are 50%. Imagine, that's a 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Translate that to the developing world. In Finland today, biofuels are 20% of replaced liquid gasoline and diesel. We mustn't use carbon capture and storage. You know, still using fossil fuels, but capturing the CO2 emissions and burying them. And as I already said, we mustn't or must not use carbon taxes. I can tell you the fossil fuel industry loves this rigidity. It plays right into their hands. So what I'm asking you to think about is to start debating yourself, challenging yourself, and be careful not to let perfection be the enemy of good. Thank you very much.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening.